You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on January the 26th, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24, with me, Robert Bound, and Emma Barnett.
On today's programme, we find out what importance the simple feeling of disgust carries in our lives and how it has influenced the evolution of societies.
We also talk about the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca that every Muslim must make at least once in their lifetime, if they can. The British Museum opened a big show on this today, and we meet someone who's made that pilgrimage.
During the next 60 minutes, we also find out if yet another Men's Fashion Week is necessary, now that London is about to get its own.
All that and a lot more on Midori House, here on Monocle 24.
First, let's get the latest news from around the world with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Rescuers have recovered three bodies from the rubble of three buildings that collapsed in downtown Rio, highlighting the creaky infrastructure of the city that will host the 2014 Soccer World Cup and the 2016 Olympics. The buildings, one 20 floors high, collapsed on Wednesday night in a cloud of dust and smoke, just one block away from the city's historic municipal theatre. Rescue teams pulled six people alive from the rubble, but at least 18 people were still missing. Jean-Claude Masse, the Frenchman who sparked a global health scare by selling substandard breast implants, was arrested today as Marseille prosecutors build a case against him for manslaughter. The detention could lead within hours to Masse being placed under formal investigation on suspicion of manslaughter and causing bodily harm. Matt Steele reports.
Police in France have arrested Jean-Claude Masse, who ran the now-defunct PIP. The company's implants were pulled from the market after fears they can rupture and leak silicon inside the body. Governments around the world have issued varied guidance on whether women should have them removed or not. PIP's website says it's delivered to more than 60 countries.
Canada is very concerned about the economic problems facing Europe and the United States and fears they could become even more severe in the future. The Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper told the World Economic Forum in Davos that the uncertain international outlook meant he would focus on boosting the Canadian economy by cutting red tape as well as slowing the growth of spending. Canada is particularly impatient with what it sees as foot-dragging by Eurozone countries and has urged Europe to do what it takes to solve its debt crisis. A 10-month-old revolt against President Bashar al-Assad edged closer to the Syrian capital today as troops battled rebels in a town just north of Damascus, and a provincial governor spoke of negotiating local ceasefires. In the tense suburb of Harasta, nearby troops were deployed in strength. Gunfire was close enough to be heard from central Damascus during the night. The British Prime Minister David Cameron has dismissed any prospect of taking military action against President Assad's regime, but vowed to tighten the ratchet in all the ways we can. Britain and France have joined efforts at the United Nations to end Assad's rule. Several diplomats said they were working with Qatar and other Arab delegations on a new draft resolution supporting an Arab League plan that envisages Assad stepping down and making way for a unity government to halt the bloodshed of the 10-month uprising. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said that Israel's attitude was the biggest barrier to the resumption of Palestinian-Israeli peace talks. Abbas made the remarks after talks with Jordan's King Abdullah in Amman. Abbas and the Jordanian leader discussed latest efforts to make peace in the Middle East and create an independent Palestinian state. After the talks, Jordan's foreign minister Nasser Judeh spoke at a press conference.
First of all, Jordan, we are a stakeholder in all the final status issues. Secondly, the absence of a negotiating process is detrimental to all, not just regional security, but the rest of the world. We always say peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis is peace of mind for the rest of the world.
And the Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, Peter O'Neill, gave a televised national address in Port Moresby today to announce that a military mutiny in the early hours of the morning in the Pacific Islands nation had come to an end and that the government was fully in control of its military barracks. The address put an end to a dramatic day in the country's ongoing political crisis. Soldiers loyal to the former Prime Minister, Michael Somare, staged a mutiny earlier in the day, putting the military commander under house arrest and demanding O'Neill reinstate Somare as the leader of the resource-rich South Pacific country. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Nick Kelly. And you should meet Emma Barnett.
Hello, Emma.
Barnett, Nick Kelly,
nice
Nick Kelly,
to see
Emma
you.
Barnett. New
Enchanted.
Blood. New blood on the Midori House show.
Hopefully not too much blood.
Breaking
yeah.
news.
No. Well, come on. Sorry, you're wearing a red cardigan.
I am. I'm asking for it.
In other naming news, Peter O'Neill, the president of Papua New Guinea. Doesn't sound like a very Papua New Guinean name, does it?
No,
we
not
sort of
at
made
all.
A face at each other and his name came up. I was like, wait a minute, he sounds like sort of maybe the manager of Doncaster United. Peter O'Neill.
Prime Minister, don't upgrade him.
All right, okay. But anyway, it's time now for the global weather outlook with only one man, Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
Europe's weather first, and the entire eastern half of Europe is experiencing some very cold weather. It's likely that the big freeze will become more severe in the coming days and spread to Germany, for example. For the time being, occasional rain from the UK to Holland, and any really cold weather, if at all, isn't possible in Western Europe until next week. Here's Friday's City Outlook. In London, 7 degrees and partly cloudy. In Berlin, 6 Celsius, also partly cloudy. Warsaw, minus 4 with a few clouds. And in Moscow, minus 13 degrees the high, and sunshine. North America now. Rain on and off for Washington, D.C. and the Big Apple for the end of the week. It's even been snowing in parts of New England too. More of that to come. Meanwhile, in California, the sun is shining and we have some unseasonably hot weather. At LAX, temperatures of around 27 Celsius Thursday. The hot and sunny weather will last all weekend. Here's Thursday's City Outlook. In San Francisco, 18 Celsius and sunshine. Chicago, 2. Snow flurries are possible. New York City, a mild 10 and rain. In Miami, it's 27 with a thundershower chance. Here's a look at other world centres. In South America, Buenos Aires, hot and sunny. The temperatures are likely to keep climbing during the end of the week up to 27. Early next week, as high as 35. South Africa, Cape Town, also hot. Temperatures up to 34 degrees Friday and Saturday. And in Australia, the coastal tropics in Western Australia state likely to experience a cyclone in the coming days. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Thomas. It's 18:07 in London and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 Tagat, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yokosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are tuned in to Midori House with me, Robert Pound, and the new Emma Barnett. Now, it's such a simple feeling, but with so much power, disgust. Now, we've got on the line Daniel Kelly, an assistant professor of philosophy at Purdue University, Indiana, whose new book, Yuck, is receiving critical acclaim for its exploration of disgust as part of the evolutionary history that makes us who and what we are. Daniel, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Very good, thanks. Now, I want to take looking at your book, at least in the British form that we have it in front of us. It's got a well-mannered looking guy in a suit looking at a glass of something that's clearly off, and making a horrible face at it. Yuck seems to be yuck's obviously the word, but where did the idea for the book come from? Did you have a bad vintage one day and decide to write a book about it?
No, it wasn't anything that simple. There's interesting thing about disgust is there's been a ton of research on it just in the last 15 or 20 years, and some of the research has been showing that it plays maybe a subliminal but very important role in a lot of moral judgments. So there was a lot of interesting work to look at out there and try to draw all the pieces together.
So it's a sort of, in terms of taste, it's similar to fear. Is it a similar part of the brain or a similar part of our makeup that responds to being scared of something?
It's got a lot of characteristics in common with fear. It's actually fear and disgust are associated with different parts of the brain, but they both have sort of a psychological reflex element to them. So when something sort of startles you or scares you, you just sort of react in a certain way. Same thing with disgust. When you look at something or see something which is disgusting, you just react in a certain way. And there's a whole suite of elements to the reaction, which can be pieced apart and talked about. Including that facial expression that you mentioned on the book and that everyone seems to recognize very easily.
Daniel, what was the most fascinating thing that you found out in your study for this book?
Some of the most interesting things were the extremely wide range of things which are actually disgusting. So some of the most common ones and the things that people think of immediately when you talk about disgust are nasty foods that they don't like, or something that you might step in if you walk down a garbage-strewn street,
or horrible
or
people.
Like yeah, it scales up, so it has a social dimension to it too. So people who do extreme forms of hypocrisy, or even someone who's on the wrong side of the other side of a political issue from yourself, you might even come to find them sort of slightly revolting if they're really vehement in their views. So it's not just sort of the muck and filth of the earth, but it also has the sort of abstract moral element to it as well.
And how has it changed over the years?
It's a good question. I mean, one of the things that seems like it can change a lot, maybe on sort of a historical time scale, is the objects of disgust. We see this even at sort of one snapshot in time. It changes from one culture to the next. And then what's found disgusting in a culture as it sort of evolves through time, that can shift a lot as well. But maybe the interesting thing is the response itself, so that face, that feeling of disgust, the way, what happens to you when you're disgusted by something, that seems like it remains relatively stable across time and across cultures.
Daniel, I wondered, as I was talking, going back to the face on the book, do people learn the behavior of disgust? I mean, if one person's disgusted about something at a dinner table, one person has to be more disgusted than they are in order to sort of save face almost. Is disgust more fashionable than it used to be?
It's certainly more fashionable as an object of study right now. Uh-huh. whether it's more fashionable to be disgusted, again, there's sort of this goes with it ebbs and flows with a different cultural moment.
But Daniel, I mean, I suppose what I'm quite fascinated by is why do we need to understand disgust? Why do we need to even think about it as something in society? I'm struggling to understand what I need to understand about being disgusted at something.
Well, if you're interested in the way humans and human minds and human sociality and human morality evolve, disgust is it's kind of a good case study because it allows you to look at the ways in which the brain, it sits sort of on the divide between nature and nurture. So some of the elements of disgust, you don't have to learn. You don't have to learn how to be disgusted. But there's a role for nurture to play as well, because a lot of times you learn from your peers or from your parents what it is that you're supposed to be disgusted by.
And Daniel, just to take it right back, somewhere between cavemen and being disgusted at a dinner table in 21st century Indiana or London, was this something that obviously was brought up as part of the evolutionary chain to make us not eat things that are, not eat speckled toadstools and not kind of think that the young of saber-toothed tigers might be particularly appetizing to put on our fire as food one night? I mean, is it all linked to that same evolutionary chain?
Yeah, there's a good case to be made that the emotion of disgust started out as this protective element of our psychology that keeps us, like you said, it keeps us from eating things which might be poisonous. I mean, humans are omnivores, so we needed some way to sort of narrow down the range of options we had. But another important and probably very evolutionarily ancient role that disgust plays is that you can think of it as our psychological immune system almost. It keeps us on the lookout for things which might infect us or other people who might have diseases and might be able to get us sick. So it's not just food-based. It looks like it also plays this role in protecting us from parasitic infection of any sort.
And presumably it's something that's become more and more fine-tuned over the years so that we can kind of like, we can sort of turn up our noses at a corked bottle of wine rather than something that might have been genuinely murderous in the olden days.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's part of what's interesting about the disgust system is it can be calibrated by what social milieu you grow up in or what sort of fashionable sensibilities you might acquire over the course of your lifetime. And so it can be really finely honed such that, you know, you now like the $50 bottle of wine, but you're revolted by the $5 bottle.
And so are all our wallets, I'm sure. Daniel Kelly on the line from Purdue University in Indiana. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House here from Studio One on Monocle 24. Now it's song time. This is Leaky Lee and I Follow Rivers.
That was Licky Leaf, I Follow Rivers. It's 1818 in London. And in just a moment on Midori House, we'll be finding out about the new exhibition in the British Museum, which has opened today.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
Culture with me, Robert Bounds, will make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar.
They're like metal, glam, monster band.
They've literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist?
That's Culture with me, Robert Bounds, available all week. Find us at monocle.com or iTunes, download our app and listen on your phone, or just stay tuned to Monocle 24. Thanks for tuning in.
Now, the British Museum opened today a major exhibition on Hajj, the Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca. This display is the first of its kind and includes pilgrims' diaries and priceless ancient manuscripts. Sophie Grove, hello.
Hi.
You visited the British Museum today.
I did. It was fascinating. And I got more or less kicked out when Prince Charles turned up to see the exhibition that I was in. So he's there now. But it's
and you're not. You're with us, yeah. Telling us all about what you could see before
he
arrived.
He can make it, could he?
Yeah.
He got stuck in traffic.
I know. Well, it was really fantastic. It's something of a sort of social sort of look at the Hajj. There's some beautiful artefacts and manuscripts, as you say, some incredible sort of embroidered tapestries and incredible sort of ceremonial tents that are from, you know, the 19th century when they used these convoys that they used to get to Mecca. But then most of the most, for me, the most intriguing stuff is the footage and the photographs of you know, this inner sanctum, which, you know, if you're not Muslim, you'll never see in real life. So they do that very, very well, and it's something the British Museum has been doing for some time. You know, they sort of you know, like, actually recently they did the Afghan exhibition where they looked at all the artifacts and beautiful sort of gold hoards of Afghanistan, and similarly with ancient Persia, and they sort of throw a lens onto these places that, you know, we don't know anything about, and use history and art to sort of discuss the sort of contemporary as well.
Do you think it's worth the hype that sort of surrounded this because it is the first of its kind?
I think so. I mean, I wasn't completely overwhelmed. I think that it's very carefully put together in the sense that, you know, the they've been collaborating with King Abdullah, King Abdulaziz, rather, a public library in Riyadh, and they're sort of teaming up with the Saudis, and you know, everything, you can tell everything's been so carefully, diplomatically negotiated. I mean, it is. Quite tenuous in that sense, and just speaking to some of the curators, you know, it really is a balancing act in that sense, because, you know, even though it's this incredible historical you know, phenomenon as well, it's still happening now, and it's somebody, you know, it's you know, a ritual that, you know, millions of people do every year.
I want to ask you about that, Sophie, the kind of sensitivity that you have to give something like this. I mean, obviously, you know, the West has got into trouble for stupidly trying to depict Muhammad and all this sort of stuff. But this is presumably like a history lesson about something, more of a history lesson, I guess.
Can you
tell that they've been sensitive when you walk around the show? Not that you're an expert on Islam, but
no,
you know, it's a kind of well-mannered, is it a bit of a well-mannered
it's
tour?
It's very well-mannered. Yeah. And it feels a bit like a religious, you know, an RE class. Because in a way...
I used to love that.
Yeah. Like, and then this is what people do.
It's just a memory test.
Yeah. But then, I mean, actually, I'm doing it down because there's some fantastic stuff that, you know, they have diaries and pictures of Richard Burton, Richard Francis Burton, the explorer, who is the one of the few non-Muslims to sort of break into Mecca in the 19th century, and he posed as a Afghan doctor because he was blue-eyed, and they sort of they bought that, so they're looking at him, and he was kind of a falconry expert and all these crazy sort of, you know, he was a real wild card. And there were some other really fantastic figures that they really look at, and there's some brilliant, you know, first-hand sort of historical intriguing stuff. And they also look at sort of you know, the modern evolution of the Hajj, so how it's changed. And
it's a big business as well, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's not just, I mean, I won't say burger vans, but there's a lot of roadside entertainment, isn't there? And refreshment.
Thomas Cook was the first travel group to take it on as something for British Muslims, wasn't it? And when I was reading about this, I was fascinated to see they dropped it because it actually wasn't profitable. Mm. They got rid of that contract and they didn't do the Hajj anymore. And I don't know who it went to, but I think it's probably just spread around. I mean, my thing that I wanted to sort of understand was, do you get an understanding of the feeling of when you're there, or at least understand why people feel compelled to go when you go to this exhibition?
You absolutely do. And I think that's really one of the most interesting things. And also to look at the Hajj throughout the ages. And they have this incredible sort of geographical orientation that you sort of have with these kind of epic maps that they have of different routes that people have been doing for hundreds and thousands of years, however long, and the sort of Africa, Middle East, the European route, the Asian route, and how people have got there and how that's changed. I mean, it's fascinating for us as a design magazine, and all these leaks that you've seen from Zaha Hadid. Is she going to be doing the next kind of development? You know, is this high-speed rail has been added? Actually, fun enough, they didn't go into that, but it was really there was a sense of history, and it's just so wonderful to see the Kaaba and see those images of people praying. It's really
Just fine. Actually, are there lots of photographs of people making their way? I mean, ever since photographs existed, but are there depictions of people making their way to Mecca, or is it more the artifacts?
There are pictures of people ironing their sort of clothes and doing their rituals. It's really quite it's vivid, so it's definitely worth seeing.
All right, well, Sophie Grove. Unfortunately, not Prince Charles. Thank you very much for joining us. After the news headlines, we're going to be speaking to someone who's actually gone on the Hajj. But before that, this is Lady Hawk. Coming up in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be hearing what kind of an experience it is to go on Hajj, the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca.
We'll also hear what it means to the fashion industry that London is getting a major men's fashion event. But first, here's the news with Nick Kelly.
Thanks, Emma. Rescuers have recovered three bodies from the rubble of three buildings that collapsed in downtown Rio de Janeiro. Six people were pulled alive from the rubble, but at least 18 people are still missing. Jean-Claude Mas, the Frenchman who sparked a global health scare by selling substandard breast implants, was arrested today as prosecutors in Marseille build a case against him for manslaughter. A 10-month-old revolt against President Bashar al-Assad edged closer to the Syrian capital today as troops battled rebels in a town just north of Damascus. And a provincial governor spoke of negotiating local ceasefires. The Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, Peter O'Neill, gave a televised national address in Port Moresby today to announce that a military mutiny in the early hours of the morning in the Pacific Islands nation had come to an end. The Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, has challenged the Islamist sect Boko Haram to identify themselves and state clearly their demands as a basis for talks. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says the EU, not Iran, will suffer under new sanctions banning Iranian crude, as lawmakers say they might cut supplies to Europe ahead of the July the 1st deadline. Egypt's military-led authorities have told several American pro-democracy activists, including the son of a member of President Barack Obama's cabinet, that they cannot leave the country in what one of those affected called a de facto detention. The Kenyan finance minister Uhuru Kenyatta has resigned days after being indicted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity during violence that followed a disputed 2007 election. And the aid agency Médecins Sans Frontières has halted its work in detention centres in a Libyan city because it said its medical staff were being asked to patch up detainees midway through torture sessions so they could go back for more abuse. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
British Museum opened its new exhibition on Hajj, the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca today. The exhibition is the first of its kind and includes pilgrims' diaries and priceless ancient manuscripts, as well as trying to recreate the feeling of the pilgrimage.
But what's it like to go on the Hajj? Our guest here in the studio, Christiana Backer, has performed this pilgrimage. Hi, Christiana. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The first question should be, if you don't mind me asking, with a name like Christiana Backer, you don't sound like a natural Hajj goer. So maybe we should ask you, first of all, how you came to make this journey.
Well, it's a long story and I've written a whole book about it, which hopefully will be published later on
Indeed.
In the year. But, it's actually called From MTV to Mecca. How did I come to make the story? You know what? Every Muslim wants to go to Mecca.
Uh-huh.
It's your wish, because it's the center of Islam, the heart of Islam, the geographical center, but also the spiritual center, because every Muslim in the world prays mm-hmm. five times a day towards the Kaaba, which is in the middle of Mecca, in the middle of the Holy Mosque. So imagine if you just want to be there and want to feel, you know, the sacredness, the holiness, etc. So it's, and plus it's one of the pillars of Islam, one of the mm-hmm. five pillars. So every Muslim must go on Hajj once in a lifetime if they can afford it.
And when do you know it's your time to go? When do you know the time? You get a little itch and you think, wait a minute, I feel a Hajj coming on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in
I'm
my
sure
case,
it's just like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think again, you only get to go, they say, if you are invited by God in the end of the day. Everything can still go wrong until the last minute. You may not get your visa. Imagine 3 to 4 million people going there, you know, at the same time. I mean, it's everything could still go wrong. In my case, a lot went wrong. You know, for me, I was given a certain prayer for a certain reason in August, and I prayed it, you know, really early in the morning at the dawn time. And at some point, I had a dream. Do you want to go on Hajj? A very dark voice said, as if it would come from the universe and not from a human throat. You know, and then I thought, my goodness, is this my invitation to Hajj or something, you mm-hmm. know? And because I always wanted to go with my husband, but he never came, so I was still single. And I thought, yeah. Well, hang on a minute. Actually, it's around the Christmas time. I have time. I don't have a job to do during that time. And it just felt right. So that dream inspired me. But then I had a slipped disc a few months before the Hajj. And I thought, oh, well, there's my Hajj gone out of the window.
Obviously a big deal, because it's a properly arduous physical process, isn't it, doing this? This
yeah.
isn't just like
physiotherapists forget
packing
it.
A cool box
Can't
with some
go.
Sandwiches in and
oh,
off you go.
It's not a holiday. It is a real challenge on every mm-hmm. level. Mm-hmm. In terms of human beings, you know, you're sleeping with strangers for weeks on end in a tiny room.
How,
you know.
How long is the process from start to finish?
Well, you know, there are different packages. You can't even go alone as a Muslim woman. As a woman, you know, you have to sign up with a group and have a male, you know, companion, etc. So I went on a 3.5 week package, which also took in Medina for 1 week, which is where the Prophet was buried. As you are in the area, you kind of want to also visit Medina, the birthplace of mm. the Prophet. Peace be upon him. And then the actual Hajj itself is only a few days. However, usually people are for a week beforehand, before the Hajj in Mecca already, you know, for a week in Medina and then a few days the Hajj. So,
And just for us, I mean, we're never going to get to go, sadly, sat here listening about this, but obviously we've got this exhibition to go to. But
yeah.
When you are there and you're actually, you know, as close as you can be to
yes.
the holiest part.
Yes.
Can you just put us in the picture of how that feels and how close you got to the Holy Stone, and just tell us about what you actually go through in those moments?
I managed to touch the stone despite 3 million people
wow,
also
amazing.
Being there. You know, you basically imagine you are at a mega showbiz event, say mega rock concert. I used to work for MTV. And, you know, you're surrounded by people from morning to night every day, or a mega football, except people have a different aura. People are dressed in white. People are all there for the same reason, to praise God, to come closer to their own self, to their heart, to God, purify themselves. So people are generally very nice and very helpful, because, you know, when you wear the spiritual cloth, it's called ihram, you're not allowed to be angry. You know, you do the Hajj rituals in that spiritual cloth. The men wear two towels and women all dress in white. And you're not allowed to pluck hairs. You're not allowed to be angry. You see, it's a test, an emotional test, a test of your whole being. So, you know, so everybody's very nice. Although, you know, there is pushing and shoving and you know, you're always surrounded by people. So it's not easy. And, you know, you don't have sleep. You want to spend as much time as possible in the holy mosque. You know, you never sleep. You're dead tired. You are sick as a dog because 3 million people coughing and sneezing all over you all the time because everybody's sick. You can't avoid a Hajj flu. And, you know, basically no sleep. I mean, I felt like a zombie, to be honest, at that times. Like, and I was like,
all the festivals in the world rolled together.
Beg for a hotel. Just how much would I have spent for a night in the hotel? But no, I booked I particularly booked a hardship Hajj, mm-hmm. a real pilgrimage, and I wasn't going to be in a hotel. I shared a flat with 50 other women, you know.
And
three bathrooms.
The hardship Hajj and the Hajj flu. I like the way that it becomes this sort of adjective of its own. Yes. But I wanted to know. We talked a little bit about the commercialization of it, and the show at the British Museum doesn't mention it. Maybe for sensitive reasons, maybe not. I don't know. But there obviously is an industry about. There is an industry behind it. You book a tour. You're presumably picked up. You're taken to places. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it. But there is obviously a commercial side to it. What's by the side of the road? Are there people? Is there a business side of it? Are people selling things? I mean,
yes, of course. You know, they're selling Hajj stuff. Yeah. You know, they're selling mats. They're selling white outfits, prayer beads.
And is it quite kitschy, like Catholic sort of
not
high
at
Catholic?
All,
right.
At all? No, it's really not. It's like it's just, you know, what pilgrims need. But also, there's you see, it's market and supply and demand. Tax as Mecca gets more and more packed, taxi prices go up. You know, suddenly you're paying three times the price for a taxi as you used to before. Crooks, you know, plenty of crooks because they're high season too. So you always come across people dressed in white pretending they've been stolen, they've been robbed, you know.
Well, I do hope that when we go to the British Museum, I certainly will be. I'm not sure it will be anything on sale in that way. But thank you very much for joining us, Christiana Backer.
For a complete briefing on the business of design, join us for Section D. Every week, Monocle's design editor, Hugo MacDonald, brings you the world of design in a perfectly formed package, looking at architecture, industrial design, fashion, retail, and graphics. Monocle 24's Section D brings the world of design to you, the Monocle listener. That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. And also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and on iTunes.
It was recently announced that London is going to get its own Fashion Week, or more of a long weekend, really. The event will be called London Collections Men. But what this is, what is the significance of this news to the fashion industry? And how needed is this event going to be? On the phone, we now have Tom Stubbs, menswear stylist and writer. Hello, Tom.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us. So what I wanted to understand first and foremost from you is, has there been a big need for this in London for a long time?
We've had Men's Day that's, you know, is burgeoning and building, you know, quite a strength of interest. However, it's tacked on the end of Women's Fashion Week, and everyone's using that as a travel day. All the international press and buyers, many of them have just left and are travelling to the international shows, the women's shows in Milan by that point. So although the day has got really good, we haven't quite got the status on the schedule. So this is a big deal to be moved. Completely.
And why do you think it's happened now? I mean, obviously there's other, you know, longer days for men's fashion around the world at different events, but why is it happening in London now?
Well, it could well be the Olympics that's changed it, and that as there's going to be so much attention on London and some other sporting events that the British Fashion Council thought, let's do it. I mean, people have been lobbying for years to get it moved and to no avail, and now we've got 3 days instead of one, and we've got a lot of people behind it, so they've gone ahead and given us, like you said, a long weekend.
How do you think it's going to change men's fashion, or at least attitudes to designers coming to London to try and exhibit men's fashion?
Well, I mean, initially we've got Margaret Howe back. Margaret Howe's going to exhibit, but some of the biggies, such as Paul Smith and Burberry, we understand that they're already talking to the British Fashion Council. I mean, what they're going to do, we don't know yet long term, but it is the whole sort of Men's Day is going to be more of a sort of tour de force. So people will have to take notice with these luminaries of fashion are all on this board headed up by Dylan Jones. I mean, of GQ. I mean, he had 9 people on the ground at Milan Fashion Week. So, I mean, they're obviously taking men's fashion very seriously. So them being seriously involved in London, that alone is going to make, you know, quite a difference.
And Tom, I wanted to know, it's Rob in the studio with Emma, by the way. I wanted to know, whether this, what sort of opportunity this presents for the younger, lesser known designers, Paul Smith and Burberry and all the rest of it. It's great to be kind of trailing along in their slipstream. But is it a good place to kind of, launch careers as well this Fashion Week?
What helps with this attention is that the whole infrastructure, people get better funding and better more viewing of their shows. But that means they get money injected in and they get guests designing at more established businesses, just like happens in women's fashion. So, I mean, one thing we do well, we do edgy and street very well, and we also do traditional and tailoring, other things we own. But I was speaking to Robert Johnson at GQ, and what they're hoping to do is it's almost the middle ground. So it's the young thinking creatives being dragged into a sort of situation where they've got commercial backing. This is going to inject quite a lot of resources into that, and that's what we need. The middle ground needs developing.
And what does the government have much to do with this? I mean, is there any sort of initiative? Is there anything behind the scenes? I mean, you've mentioned some well-known magazine editors and Milan Fashion Week and that sort of momentum. But, I mean, obviously it's in the government's interest. We're always told that fashion's big business and we're very good at it and all the rest of it. But do they have kind of any official involvement?
Well, that's absolutely key. Right at the end of the list of people on the board, it says the mayor's office. Now, I mean, that couldn't really be more important, actually. I know that the culture minister gets himself down to Men's Day occasionally, but we need all of that to happen. We need to get them to throw their weight behind it and start getting us to venues, and particularly that, because we've got some fantastic venues here, just like Paris and Milan have. We don't get to use them for shows. We always end up in some grotty warehouse, and that needs to change. We need to start utilising the capital. So that's absolutely critical that they throw their weight behind it.
And Tom, I just wondered, what are the names of people that you'd like to see rocking up to this day? Maybe some of the lesser known people that you as a fashion writer can champion.
Well, new designers.
Yeah, people that perhaps maybe about some of our readers or listeners are familiar with, but the wider public aren't.
Right. Well, I mean Spencer Hart. I mean, he's reluctant to go on schedule, but I mean, it'd be great to see him at London Fashion Week. He's not done anything so far. Fantastically influential men's designer. And he's not shown yet. That would be interesting. I mean, Savile Row, we've got Heidi Amis and E. Torts already very strong. But, I mean, it'd be quite interesting to see some non-Savile Row-related sort of trendier labels embracing men's tailoring, which is one of our strengths, but with some more conviction, with some actual that's going to appear to an international market. Off the top of my head, I would say I've actually... No one's filling that spot at the moment, really.
Well, Tom, I think we're going to have to look forward to that and see how it pans out. Thank you very, very much. That's Tom Stubbs, menswear stylist and writer. Time for a song. It's The Smiths, This Charming Man.
Yes. That was, of course, The Smiths, This Charming Man. And you're tuned in to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:46 here in London. Now, the new issue of Monocle magazine is in the shop now. The magazine, that is, not the radio station, Emma. Our editor-in-chief, Tidy Relay, and our Section D editor, Hugo McDonald, discussed one of the main themes of the magazine, charm.
The lead story in the design section of the February issue of Monocle is all about charm. It's actually our inaugural charm index and what we've done.
Is it going to be an annual now, do you think?
Well, I don't know. Saying inaugural suggests that it might be, but that was maybe a bit previous of me, wasn't it?
It could be, though.
But it definitely could be. And, well, you've ruined the surprise. I was going to do a grand introduction to say that I was joined in the studio by the person who inspired it.
I can't wait.
But you just couldn't, right? Because you couldn't hold your tongue.
But you could say where the idea came from.
Well, I will do.
Okay, good.
Tyler Brulé, our editor-in-chief, penned a column that caught my eye in his Fastlane column in the FT Weekend towards the end of last year, saying that charm is dropping out of people's business plans.
Yeah, and one almost has to wonder that if it was ever even properly built into plans, because I think one of the things that we arrived at in this issue is that it's not something that you can measure. And I think that's part of the problem, is that, you know, if you're looking at, you know, your budgets, let's say if you're refurbing a hotel, it's very easy to say, okay, this is the thread count that we want on the sheets, and this is where we might cut staff. We're going to pension these people off. When it gets to actually pensioning off your concierge or your doorman, you think, oh, well, that'll make sense because we can bring in people at a lower wage. And that's actually where the charm starts to go out the door, because these are the people who have the oral history. These are the ones who remember the guests who've been going there for decades. And these are the individuals who are part of the furniture.
Exactly.
And that's actually where the story also, I think I was in a bit of a rage on a British Airways flight, because I just realized that I was just surrounded by all of these, well, not quite teenagers, but most of the people who were manning the cabin on the aircraft, they just had no connection to the passengers. They don't really have any connection to the brand at all. And again, you can see, well, of course, it probably makes sense to get rid of all of the old dears that have been working there forever. Not that always the old dears are the way to go.
I would say the old dears were probably quite integral to the charm.
Well, absolutely. I mean, a lot of airlines, and we have to qualify, there's a difference between old dears and old bags.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about what's in the hold. But I think that the old dear quotient, is important to all kinds of brands, whether we're talking about department stores, the apothecary, or airlines.
Exactly. And so to delve a little deeper into the story, one of the recurring themes actually is obviously service, which is integral to charm. And the countries that we've highlighted, we've got a beautiful restaurant from Italy. We have a fantastic institution of a cafe in Finland and an airport in Japan. These are all countries that actually employ old people who care about the level of service, and they really take pride in delivering good service. And actually, the sort of one of the defining things that we arrived at in the story was the fact that in hard economic times, return service is one of the most valuable currencies for businesses.
Absolutely, and it was a shame that this had already gone to press. But when I arrived in Auckland, one of the most wonderful things at the airport is that they're actually re-employing all of the old dears who used to work for Air New Zealand. So you have all of these wonderful ladies who are sitting behind desks. They've got, you know, great coifs. They've all have wonderful scarves. They're wearing nice suits. They're not just putting them in polder fleece and T-shirts. They have a very dignified existence, and they're there to guide people through the airport. And I just thought that is exactly, and curiously, I mean, it's exactly what they should be doing, but it's also when you go and talk to other airports, everyone says, oh, Auckland absolutely has it right. And there's no question there's a charm quotient. Also, the people who are working on the security screening are also very nice. They practically carry your bags to the plane.
And that's unusual. Well, the airport that we focused on, though, is Kagoshima, which is in southern island, or the southern tip of the southernmost island in Japan. And uniform plays a big part there as well. All the staff are decked out in the most beautiful blue uniforms with little hats. And they take such pride in their work, from keeping the airport immaculately clean to making sure that everybody feels very welcome. And speaking to the director of the airport, he said, all the staff feel incredibly lucky to work here. And they love talking to people, and they love making sure that the human experience is as high as it can possibly be.
And one of the images that you pulled out, which is great, which actually I missed when I was there, was I would call it a pond for one's feet.
Onsen. It's a traditional Japanese hot spring.
Yeah, where you don't immerse your whole body, but just up to your knees, which is just a brilliant idea. But just going back to what you were saying earlier, Hugo, that you referenced the cafe in Helsinki, and I think Cafe Ekberg is, again, it feels very Viennese in many ways. It still has newspapers on poles that you can return to their rack, and they've just got they don't have the best coffee. They may not, but actually their cakes are pretty damn good. But I mean, I've been going there for probably about 15 years, and the wonderful thing is that it never changes. And in that sense, it doesn't come down to just the people, because I'm looking at my colleague Marcus, who's finished the glass, because some of the girls can kind of be a little bit grumpy and surly who work there, but it is they just they haven't changed the furniture, and there's something wonderful about being on the banquettes, and that has a patina to which you know, money can't buy.
And patina is another big quality that's sort of resurfaced a lot in the Charming Index, as is sticking to or sort of having conviction and knowing that what you're doing speaks to a particular audience. You're not trying to spread yourself too thinly by appealing to everybody, and you're not taking everybody's opinions to heart to try and improve your business. You're thinking, this is what we do. We deliver coffee and cake, and we provide the newspapers every day. That's enough to satisfy people who come here and know what they're going to get.
And yeah, and I think on that point as well, it doesn't mean that after a decade, you know, some people might say, oh, well, it looks a little bit faded and there's a couple of chips in the chairs. And maybe there's, you know, a little bit too much, you know, whipped cream that's fallen onto the upholstered surfaces. But so what? As long as it's clean and it's well executed. And that's something that, you know, I think, you know, goes back to, you know, we chose, you know, Hamburg is also, you know, one of, you know, our most charming cities as well. And I think that's also a city which it doesn't have, you know, just one architectural style. But what it does have, I think when you go, you know, into any of these neighborhoods around the Ulster, that they're just, you know, there's a certain coziness to them. I'm not sure how much, I don't think I even voted for Hamburg. I think it just appeared on its own. But one of the reasons why I love the city is that when you go there, it reminds me a bit of North America, because it's you can be in the city center, but it feels oddly suburban. Driveways and garages and sort of really proper homes with fences and lawns. But you're right at the heart of the city.
Charm. Pick up the latest copy of Monocle to read all about it.
Should we go back to our charming host, Rob and Emma?
Yes, back to Rob and Emma.
That was our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, and the Section D editor, Hugo MacDonald. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're out of time for this Thursday's edition of Midori House, sadly. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter.
In just 3 hours' time, it's time for the Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours London time. In just a few minutes, it's time for this week's premiere of The Urbanist, a show on cities and the people in them.
Headlines are next, right here on Monocle 24. We'll play out on a song. This is Empire of the Sun, We Are the People.